Welcome to The Rippling Pages, a podcast on the craft of writing, curated and crafted by me, Liam Bishop. And spring is in the air, and we're celebrating Lighter Nights, Birdsong, and yes, still the odd shower or two with a new anthology of essays called By the River, just published by Dawn Books. It features a number of illustrious names, including Tessa Hadley, Caleb Azuma-Nelson, and the writer that I'm delighted to say that joins me today, Marshall Farrell. All these writers, they tackle the cultural, social, and psychological significance of the rivers that run through our societies and minds. There aren't many better writers to tackle that brief than Marshall, a writer and consultant psychiatrist. Marshall's Uprooting from the Caribbean to the Countryside, published by Canongate, was her memoir in which she asked difficult questions about colonial forces and racial prejudices that shape nature. Marshall used the flowers and plants in her own garden as a framing device to answer these questions, and it was a winner of the illustrious Nan Shepherd Prize. And let's go to rivers, and let's get into this essay, because I want you to tell us a little bit, if you can, just about the river or rivers that you write about. And if you can, just shed light on the effect that the rivers have on you.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be with you. It was a joy to be asked to write about rivers for this anthology. Coming from the Caribbean as I did, I was a bit of a water baby and spent a lot of my childhood in the water and in rivers. So I started this essay off with the, and it's not a river at all, it's barely a stream, a very tiny rivulet really that runs through our garden that emerges from a natural spring. But it was really the main thing that drew us to the house and that I think really made me fall in love with it when we looked at it 4 years ago. Having that river here, I mean, the sound of the water constantly, it really spoke to me of memories. And I think it really tied in so much to me of all the running water that I've spent time with in my childhood. And so it seemed really natural to base this essay on memory as a river, but it's so evocative of the rivers in Trinidad that I write about as well. These rivers on the north coast of the island, which is a much, Trinidad is very industrialized, it's got a lot of oil money, it can be quite urban in places, but the rivers that I spent time with in my childhood mainly are on the kind of north coast and the very wild bit of the island, kind of undeveloped. They sort of run from the mountain range down to tiny fishing villages, basically. And they always seem to my small self these huge expanses of space, and they seemed really magical. And there are all these kind of myths about a kind of magical being of the water back home, Mama Dlo, this goddess of the waters.
Yeah, because it is, there's so much, forgive me, you know, coming into this river that you're writing about, and it allows you to sort of expand outward in a similar way to you, the way you did in Uprooting. Lots of the writers in this book, for them, it's the site of the river. You've got Amy Key before you, talking about the site of the River Tyne and how that sort of takes her back to her family's ancestry and her sort of this kind of the kind of economic issues around living in the north and that kind of thing. Jo Hamier, she talks about the River Ouse, which is obviously and tragically the site where Virginia Woolf commits suicide. Now, I'm just trying to think about you're writing this essay and you're given this subject to write about. Did it literally start from this kind of, you know, I can sort of see yourself walking down to the stream and sort of hearing the noise.
What the noise does is we're lucky enough that we can hear, because of how the house sits in our garden, we can sort of hear running water from pretty much anywhere in the house. So what the sound of the water really does is it gets into your unconscious, really. And I remember when I first moved here, and that noise was very new, I hadn't become used to it yet, it would be in my dreams, and I would find myself dreaming of rivers and dreaming of water in a way that I hadn't done before. And I think that's why I then ended up writing about memory and from this kind of psychoanalytical place, really, because the river kind of really got into my subconscious. And I wanted the essay to feel like a river. I wanted it to kind of meander in the way that a river does, and to take sort of sometimes unexpected turns, and to take you places that you didn't necessarily know that you might be going when you start off at the beginning of a journey walking walking a river. But also, the thing that the river in this garden really spoke to me about personally was about landscape and what the presence of water can do in a landscape. And when we moved here before this, I was sort of waking a really busy life. My husband and I were both kind of NHS consultants. And there was a sense of being in kind of like these strip-lit, sterile hospital settings, and something that could feel quite arid about that and quite kind of barren. And then to land in this garden where there's this constant source of water and all the life that having a constant source of water brings, and a renewal of creativity, I suppose, because I hadn't been writing very much at all in my old life. I mean, I sort of was, but it was, quite sterile things, I suppose, reports, assessment reports, discharge reports, management, reports, that kind of thing. And I started writing creatively when I was here with this sound of water constantly imbuing my mind. And so I think that really was the thing that made the water source feel so important, the way that water can be this source of life, libido, which we kind of think of as as creativity as well as love, in a kind of analytic sense.
The sentence that you use is that you say that this river's origin, so which you presume would be the stream that's in your garden, this origin has reinfused me with creative life. You find it interesting that you say that it's reinfused. Was it a kind of was, you know, where was it a renewal? Was it a reinfusion? Well, you said it was a reinfusion. But was it a kind of, it sounds a bit like a maybe a renewal as well.
Yeah, it really was. And I suppose that's why I also write about childhood and my children, because it feels like such a renewal of that playful creativity that I had as a child. I used to write a huge amount when I was younger, and at one point dreamed of being a writer, really. And then, I was sort of very bright and academic and ended up going down this kind of route of sciences and medicine. And medicine does have its own creativity, and certainly psychiatry and psychotherapy, definitely has, it's an art form as much as anything else. And I definitely think that in working my way at each step in my career choices, I was sort of always working my way towards what felt like the most creative choice, I suppose, available to me in that moment. So yeah, that's the kind of renewal, the kind of revisitation of this sense from my childhood, really, of I suppose limitless imagination and playfulness and writing as a medium for play and playfulness in that way.
The prefix re is used quite a lot, and it is to seem to be this sort of rediscovery. And you have spoken about the return to your childhood, one way or another. Because in the some of the other essays, you know, people's return to their childhood, and as you might know, as I'm sure you know, as a psychiatrist, sometimes returning to people's childhoods can be a difficult process. How would you say that this, you know, what is it about the kind of return to your childhood for this essay that really made you kind of feel these feelings?
There's definitely a mix of pain and joy, in revisiting childhood. And I suppose I tried to bring both of those into this essay because, my childhood was in Trinidad and Tobago in the Caribbean, a former English colony. And I personally have quite mixed ancestry, but definitely some of my ancestors were enslaved people, and some others were indigenous people of the Caribbean who, were almost wiped out by the arrival of colonizers. So remembering where I am from and the sense of who I am definitely carries pain with it. And certainly when one is then trying to make a life in the kind of motherland that created a lot of that pain and trauma, from whence the colonizers came, there's always going to be pain and kind of looking at those and trying to marry those things up. And my children are English, so trying to map who they are onto a sense of who I am, is not necessarily always straightforward. And trying to give them a sense of who they are with mixed English and Trinidadian heritage, is something that I have to navigate thoughtfully. But there's also an immense amount of joy. I had a really happy childhood and definitely a really happy time splashing about in rivers. And to see my kids, to kind of take them back to those rivers of my childhood, or to see them in our stream here. And, as soon as the weather warms up and they were, we had a bit of sunshine this last weekend, and they were straight into the stream, and they strip off and they cover themselves with silt and mud, and ours is it's small, so it's not deep enough for them to swim in necessarily, but they paddle and have just such, the uninhibited nature of their kind of joyful immersion in these bodies of water, is just something that's really delightful. And I remember that delight from my childhood and really wanted to help capture some of that alongside some of the difficulty, some of the painful difficulty of the lands that these rivers run through.
And people who've written. We've had some Caribbean writers or people from the Caribbean or who have written about the Caribbean on the Rippling Pages before, and listeners will know that it sounds a beautiful place. Yeah, I mean, all the time, and all the time in the USA, and all the time sort of in uprooting as well. And as you speak, there's kind of this opposition between the sheer, beauty, and it's not always beauty, I think. It's just about the experience of being in the river, the immersion of it, getting inside, like I said there, covering, watching your children sort of cover themselves in mud and dirt and that kind of thing quite easily. I don't know if that came across in the actual, if that's sort of a way of life for you, if you find that quite an easy thing to do, or it's something that the writing process helps with. But you switch between them very, it seems very quite a natural process for you to switch between them.
I think it's something that's very important to me. And I think it's something that I hold from, well, it probably is innate to me, but it's definitely something that I hold from my therapeutic background, that actually we find ourselves very often trying to avoid pain, or trying to suppress it, trying to turn away from it and ignore it. And in a lot of ways, we're kind of conditioned to do that. Painful feelings are called bad or negative. But actually, pain, certainly an acute pain, is this really important signal from the body, the brain, the mind, that something's wrong? And actually, what we really need to do is turn towards it and attend to it and figure out what the signal is coming from. And then we can heal or address whatever kind of injury, the trauma is that caused the pain. And in turning away from it and ignoring it, we actually often only end up prolonging the problem. We end up prolonging the distress, and whatever injury or illness that's going on underneath it can end up becoming a real kind of abscess in the body, the mind. But also the other part of it is that when we try to suppress or numb or dissociate ourselves from pain, we can't do that to that one emotion in isolation. That's just not how our mind works. So when we numb pain, we numb our ability to feel joy. We numb our ability to feel awe and transcendence and all these other wonderful feelings that basically make life worth living, that make being a human being tolerable and enjoyable and kind of wonderful.
But I did think that, and I don't know if you agree with this, or maybe there's something that you seem to be sort of alluding to or saying, that there is a sort of form or the river sort of makes you think about how things are. We try to erase things, we try to remove things from sort of history, from ourselves, from our pasts. But some of the sentences just seem to allude to the sense of it. And it is sort of sometimes when you are talking about some of the kind of more colonial themes, was it that you write about this, the foundation of humanity and how enslaved ancestors came to be subjugated and controlled? Why, why is the river so powerful, I guess, in writing about that particular subject?
I definitely carry a sense of erasure within me. there are many of my stories and of my family stories that I just don't know, that have been deliberately forgotten in many cases. The kind of British colonial government in particular has a wonderful track record in deleting stories so that it sort of covered up after itself when it sort of left the colonies. But also a lot of them have been hidden out of shame, you know, kind of the legacy of diminishing one set of people in relation to another means that there's a huge amount of shame in the idea of who might have been one's ancestors. And in particular, I'm thinking about my Indigenous great-great-grandmother, who I now know about and who we suspected when I was a child. But my maternal grandmother, who carried really strong Carib features, we used to refer to them as a Carib people. I think they prefer now to be known as the First Peoples of Trinidad. She had really strong features, but she absolutely denied being of that heritage. There has since been a reclamation of that. People are much more proud now of their heritage. But she denied it, and it's only in much in you know kind of after her death that another cousin went and investigated, and they had to go to you know some of the other islands to kind of try and track down relatives and documents and things, and we now know that that it's true that there was an Indigenous grandmother who was born on one of the other islands, and she married a Scottish missionary, and it was actually in the last volcanic explosion in St. Vincent, not the most recent one, a few years ago, but in like 1914, I think, that she left and ended up coming to Trinidad. And that's how I ended up eventually being born in Trinidad. So those stories have been erased, actually. And with that kind of loss of the memory of who we are, you know, your memory helps make up yourself. And so this erasure of our stories of ourselves makes it then really hard to know who you are and to have a strong sense of who you are.
There is, it'd be quite an easy metaphor to reach for, wouldn't it? You know, memory sort of flows like a river, and things come into our mind and then sort of go, and you know, things return, that thing. But this, I think this idea of erasure is quite a really unexpected and powerful idea about how what the river could represent. Yeah, it's I guess my question then, are things really ever erased? Do they really properly ever disappear? Or is it, you know, it's always a kind of return, you know, return of the oppressed and that kind of thing. Do things come back?
I would say that probably things can't actually be permanently erased because I think things live on in our bodies and they live on, I think they live on in an embodied way. And actually, when you think about it, speech and language, the way we mostly think of telling our stories, that only makes up about, we think, 7% of human communication. You know, it's a tiny fraction, actually, of the way that we communicate. And actually, the vast majority of the way that we communicate with one another as a species is unspoken. And so, yes, I think these stories do get passed on, actually, even though they may not be named. But I suppose what I'm interested in is in finding ways to bring words to the unspoken. Because I think that's then when you can work with the story, you know, that's when you can do something with it.
It's that idea of sort of resistance as well, you know, resistance of these stories coming to light. Okay, what we're gonna do now is gonna have a quick break, but do join us after, and we're gonna talk more about Marcel's essay and her book Uprooting. If you're enjoying today's episode as well, why not drop us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast provider? It helps increase the reach of the episode, which helps increase the reach of these fantastic books like Marcel's. Thanks very much. See you soon. I want to sort of, if we can, sort of bring these themes back to the actual rivers themselves within these essays and the kind of devices that you use to sort of link up these stories. So you at first you don't make the stream in your garden explicit in terms of you don't tell us where it links to And we find out that it links to the River Avon, which obviously runs through Bristol. Infamously, the site where the statue, and you do write about this, where Colston, the slave trader, was pulled down in the city
Yes.
centre. But what I found is that this is the moment in the essay where you make explicit the connection between the stream and the river, but it's also where you seem to make explicit this connection in your essay between colonialism and the river.
I like leaving the reader questioning things. I suppose I could have made it explicit right at the beginning of the essay, but I quite like leaving space for the reader to put their own stories in as well. And when a space is only partly formed, not necessarily defined by you knowing that this is the Avon River, there's space for you to be there with me at any stream that you might have played with in your childhood, that you might have played in your childhood. It creates, I think, for me, certainly, a sense of kind of spaciousness. But it does leave a sense of uncertainty, and I suppose I like uncertainty. I like working with uncertainty. I just find it a more open, kind of free place to be in. You're a bit grounded, you're at a stream in a garden, but actually, it could be any stream in any garden.
In saying that, and talking about the subjects that you speak about, there's a moment where you write, it's thought that, talking about Bristol here, it's thought that the city's trade has brought over 500,000 Africans into slavery in the Caribbean, perhaps including some of my ancestors. Could this essay be written about another river? I know it's very specific to the locality of Bristol and the Avon and that kind of thing, but is this a sort of a universal story about rivers as well?
I didn't intend it to be, no. So that's why we got quite specific at the end. There's something that I think that feels quite full circle in my life about finding myself living and kind of putting down roots at the source of a river that would have caused my ancestors so much pain. And there is something that feels like a reclamation. You talk about me using these RE words quite a lot. And that's intentional. It feels as though I'm trying to reclaim, to renew, to bring something back to life. Not just for myself, but for the generations that go forward from here. In the end, it is quite specific. It is quite a specific and quite personal story about my family and my kind of life coming, feeling as though it's kind of coming full circle in a way. But I suppose what's universal about that is, and I think some of the other writers refer to this. Amy Jane Bear, I think, does it quite beautifully in her essay, talking about the way that rivers do come full circle. The way that water, the water cycle, the water on this planet, it does come full circle. And so it is this very beautiful and quite powerful metaphor for thinking about, or a way into thinking about themes like that.
Yeah, definitely, and it comes, in a very nuanced way. It just feel like it's a very sort of global essay to some extent. But as a writer, actually, within Uprooting as well, very sort of global ideas that are encased within this. Well, it all starts from your garden, it seems. From the flowers in your garden to the rivers in your garden. It must be. Must be a magical place. I mean, does this would you invoke somebody else, or for somebody else, could they have a similar experience? Could they, be inspired by similar things by their own garden, or is it particular to certain
Oh,
gardens, maybe?
no, I absolutely think so. And I think that's one of the things that interests me and that fascinates me so much, actually. Because a lot of nature writing often, well, I suppose kind of traditional nature writing often seemed to deal with the wild, the kind of the big expanse. And I'm really interested by what's kind of just outside your back door, what's just underneath your feet, and actually how fascinating that is, but also, as you say, just how global its reaches. one of the consequences of the colonial trade is that the ordinary common English garden is chock full of plants that have come from all over the world. A standard English garden is a hugely global experience. And I think that's becoming more known. That's kind of coming more to the fore now in kind of gardening media and horticulture. People are kind of talking about that a little bit more. But for a long time, I don't think that really was part of people's consciousness. It was seen as being this kind of very English thing. But actually, because of England's history, very English things are actually worldwide. And in a way, that's a gift, but it also is a gift that has had all this pain and trauma attached to it. And I think we need to look at both. We're very good at looking at the gift of the beautiful English garden. We're not so good at considering the difficulty and the pain that kind of came along with that. And we need to look at both. We because both is the truth. And only when we kind of are standing from a point of truth can we really move forward into anything new. Or else we just end up kind of doomed to keep repeating the past. We end up kind of trapped in this place of being kind of compelled to compete, to come to carry out the mistakes of the past.
Perhaps for someone who doesn't have access to sort of, not even a big garden space, just a garden themselves. How do they sort of connect with these ideas, do you think? I think it feels like at times that it is a very politicized, can be a very politicized argument, a very politicized space, while also at the same time it's very unpoliticized. It feels like something that, the great outdoors, the sunshine, and get out, breathe the air and that kind of thing. But also, yeah, it's not as easy to do that if you've got to travel. If you're living in an inner city suburb and you've got to travel, however far on a train, the cost of that, the safety of that, and that kind of thing.
No, but you're absolutely right. It shouldn't be a political issue. It's actually one of our basic needs. We're mammals, we're human mammals, and we need sunshine and light and air and fresh water and contact with earth. These are the things that we just really need biologically as well as psychologically to thrive. And so it's not a political question, it's one of survival, really, ultimately.
But I think this brings us back quite nicely to another theme that the river represents. And I think ties into this sort of experiential idea. And it's this idea of play. And there is a lightness to this. There's a lot of lightness to this experience and to this essay and what you write about. And you spoke about at the start or nearer the start about your children playing in the rivers. But just tell me about what this idea of play means to you.
Yeah, play is so important. It's absolutely one of the most vital things that we need. And it's something that we not only neglect, but we kind of have been taught to sort of dismiss and as though it's kind of a bad thing. Certainly as an adult, you're kind of wasting time if you play. But actually, play is one of the key ways in which our brain develops. A child's brain absolutely requires play. It is the way in which they learn everything. Relationship and what the world means and what it is and who they are and how they are in the world, all of that understanding comes through play. And actually, it's something that we really need to hold on to as we grow into adulthood, or else we stop being able to learn. we learn about the world and about ourselves through play. And it's really interesting that that's how our brain works. So we need this lightness, we need this kind of joy and to follow our curiosity and to let ourselves do things just for the sake of it. Because that nourishes us and nurtures us and keeps us alive. Play is the real source of our kind of life and thriving. So it always feels really important to me to try and bring an element of play and or to hold an element of play in my writing, because that is just such a vital part of who we are, and of what we need.
It's not the, do you know what? This is probably the third episode in a row that we've had sort of, and whether or not this is what you're alluding to, but sort of allusions to Donald Winnicott. So very niche podcast. I mean, is it the writing process for you, or is it nature that really delivers this?
It's both. It's really interesting. Whenever I have written creatively, whenever I've come back to creative writing in my life, and I sort of realize this in retrospect, actually, when I was writing Uprooting, all of the times that I've come to a practice of creative writing have happened when I've lived in a place with a garden, and when I've therefore had opportunity to come into some kind of relationship with nature and the rest of the natural world. Particularly for uprooting, I often talk about how I think that the garden is a co-author of uprooting. And in many ways, it felt as though I sort of channeled words that emerged from the soil. You know, it really felt as though that writing flowed from the place as much as from me. So, you know, it was a real co-creation of me and that place. And I suppose, actually, in a way, that was also very true of this essay about rivers. But I wasn't in those places, particularly the kind of rivers in Trinidad. I wasn't there when I was writing about them. So perhaps that's why it ended up being more of a memory river, you know, because I was writing about my relationship with those places as I remembered them more often than as I was kind of in the act of experiencing them.
Garden is a co-author to this to the book. What a fantastic phrase. But Marshall, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast. It's a lovely way to end the interview. By the River, Essays from the Water's Edge is out now from Dawn Books. But otherwise, Marshall, it's been a pleasure having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for giving up your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real joy.